Welcome to Moonshine Murmurs, a podcast from Stillhouse Press. Thank you for joining us as we interview our authors about their writing and process as artists. We're so glad you're here. You can find more about our press and the books discussed in this episode at our website, stillhousepress.org.
Hi, listeners. Welcome to the Stillhouse Press podcast, Moonshine Murmurs. My name is Carol Mitchell, and in this episode, I will be speaking with Tien Eyre. Her debut novel, Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality, was released by Stillhouse Press in November 2023. It is a work of speculative fiction, and you can pick up a copy at the Stillhouse Press website, stillhousepress.org. A little about me. I'm an author. My latest book, What Start Bad a Morning, was released in 2023 with Central Avenue Publishing. More relevantly, I'm a professor at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and an editor at Stillhouse Press, which is an amazing student-run press affiliated with George Mason University. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Carol.
You're welcome. I heard a lot about your book, Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality, while it was in production. Stillhouse released two speculative fiction novels in 2023, Yours and Supernormal by Josh Denslow. And I was working with Josh's book at the time and struck by how the books are very, very different, yet at their centers so similar, both really getting at the humanity of their subjects, touching in part on the idea of what do you do when given a potentially powerful gift, and both using siblings to explore this. So that was really interesting to me. But before I get ahead of myself, let's begin with telling our listeners a little bit about your book, because this is a fairly complex narrative with a lot to unpack, which we'll try to do in this interview. But what's the elevator pitch? How would you explain this in a few words to someone?
Oh, sure. I always tend to be a little bit long-winded, so just cut me off if I'm going on too much or saying things that are not helpful. But the elevator pitch for this book, more or less, the long elevator pitch for this book, is that it's a near future world in which immortality has become a reality, but it is very expensive to produce, and it requires mass amount, the Infinity Serum, which gives people immortality, requires mass amounts of human blood. So this basically leads to the division of the world into three segments. One is the very wealthy, who are immortal. There's a small middle class. And then there are large quantities of people who just live on these massive compounds where they donate their blood in exchange for room and board. And my novel explores the fates of families at either ends of this sort of spectrum. One is a family that has enough money for immortality, but only for one person, and they're trying to decide who should get it. And the other family lives on one of these compounds, but they want to move back into the normal world and sort of have some social mobility, have a chance at a more normal life. So yes, it very much explores how the world changes with immortality when immortality is a scarce resource and how it affects the world.
Great. Thank you. I think that's an excellent elevator pitch. As I said, it is a fairly complex novel, so I do understand it's not easy to get it into one sentence. You know, that would definitely not do it justice at all. So I really found the premise fascinating, this idea of immortality. It's something I'm writing about a little bit myself. And as I was reading your book, I kept thinking, like, would I want this? How would my life change if I never aged? Like, so my first question on that topic, you know, is like, why immortality? Or I guess a better question is, what's the origin story of this book? What made you think about this, come up with this idea?
I always feel like I should have some incredibly deep, insightful, thoughtful answer to this question. But the truth is, my husband had a dream about immortality, and I sort of took it and ran with it. His was just sort of this idea that immortality was really expensive. And then I started thinking about the implications of that and how we would decide who gets it, how it would change the structure of society. I, at one point, had a notebook, like 3 or 4 pages of a notebook, just filled with different ideas of how this would impact the world and directions in which I could take this premise. And eventually, I ended up picking a couple of the potential plot lines that I really loved and developing it into a novel. Yeah, so it's kind of a quirky origin story and not nearly as thoughtful as I'd like it to be, but that's the truth.
I actually think that's fascinating. I love the idea that it was a dream, you know, and not even your dream, but a dream that your husband had and shared with you, and you just took it and ran with it in this really amazing and interesting way and very thoughtful way as well. Because, you know, you think about so many things in this novel, which, you know, on the surface, one might think, oh, immortality would be amazing. I would love to live forever. But as you go through this book, it really makes you start to look at it and wonder, you know, there's a lot that comes with that, a lot of responsibility, a lot of changes. And I think for me, one of the things that really connected me to the book was just how effortlessly you built that world and set up the parameters of how immortality works in your world. And I'm not surprised to hear that this took a lot of time and a lot of notebooks and a lot of tossing out of ideas and building new ones, because it was just so well done and well crafted. And the question that's somewhere in there is, how difficult was it to decide on and communicate to this to your readers, like how this world works? Because I found myself immediately understanding the world I was in as soon as I started writing. I was like, okay, I know this place. And even how immortality worked in the setting. And if there are writers out there listening, especially writers of speculative fiction, you know this isn't easy to do. So can you talk about that a little bit from a craft perspective, perhaps, or?
Yeah, of course. I think I've gotten a lot better at this since I wrote Finding Meaning. Back then, you know, I was attempting to write a novel. I don't have an MFA. I've never taken a creative writing class. I just sort of sat down with my laptop and started typing. I had certainly the structure for the world, but I didn't have the details of the plot down at all. I sort of knew where I wanted to start and where I wanted to end up, but I wasn't sure about the middle. And the result of this is that I got about 150 pages in, realized I didn't have anywhere to go, tossed the whole thing out, and started all over again. And then I got like 100 pages in, and the exact same thing happened. And it took me three or four attempts before I was finally able to actually finish the novel. And then I ended up tossing out the entire second half and doing that all over again as well. So it was a long, arduous process because I didn't. Like these days, when I attempt to write a novel, I outline it first, and the outline changes, of course, as I get into the story. But I don't do so much writing, tossing out, and starting over. But on this sort of first attempt, it was just a lot of trial and error, and it took far longer than it should have. I don't recommend this process to anyone, but it's what I had to do to get it right. So.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that you stuck with it. I mean, it sounds like quite a painful process, and I think that it says a lot about you and your dedication to this craft and to this writing that you know, did that. A lot of people would have given up after the second time that they tossed
I have plenty of those
150
novels in my bottom drawer too, the ones that are like half written that I just like, nope.
I hear you. I hear you. But you know, I'm really glad that you stuck with that and then stuck with the world building, because you know, the novel, just to give our readers a little idea of this, the novel begins with Hudson's journey. This is one of the families that you're following to the compound, which is where the people who are donating the blood are housed. And you know, that journey paints a picture of this world that's really familiar, as I said in the beginning. As soon as I started reading it, I was like, yes, I know where this was. It's in the future. Human labor has been replaced with automation. Most of the family's friends, the children's friends, their parents don't have jobs. The factory where Mark's dad worked had moved to China. And so this is, you know, you paint a picture that is not real, but it feels like it could be real, very real in a not too long time. So, you know, speculative work often ventures light years away from our present, you know, looking at outer space or thousands of years into the future. So, why did you choose to set this book in a world just so close to our own in terms of the time frame where, you know, still talking about Starbucks and KFC and all that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of answers to that. One is just that a sort of separate question that I'd been thinking about a lot around the time my husband had his dream was the disappearance of jobs to automation and outsourcing. It's something that has become even more relevant now, I think, with the advent of ChatGPT. But even back then, we were starting to see, you know, self-checkout at the grocery store, for example. And there's only been an increase in this trend. So I think I was already, that was a question that was already on my mind a lot. And it was something that I saw happening in the near future and not 1,000 years from now. And so that's a big part of it. But secondly and separately is, I think that one thing that speculative fiction can do really well is to illuminate issues that are relevant to our present, but to talk about them in contexts that make them less politicized. So we can get at a lot of important issues without having sort of very, while simultaneously avoiding topics, specifics that are very touchy or very sensitive. But I think if you set something too far in the future, it can maybe take away from that a little bit. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, this is kind of a convoluted answer, but what I'm trying to say is putting something in the near future, for me, is this sweet spot where everything is familiar enough that it feels relatable, but not so close that it's overly sensitive or that it's too politicized.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think that it really worked in this sense, because it also, one of the things it did is allowed me to sort of focus on the ideas that you were bringing across without thinking too much about, without being distracted too much by the what was happening and, you know, new fandangle things that you may have come up with that is going to happen 100 years in the future. And so I think that it really works that well. It works well to achieve what you were talking about, what you were saying just now. And I also think that one of the things that it does really well is allows us to focus on the class differences that these families are, that we're seeing through the eyes of these families, the Hudsons and the Davenports. So my next question will be, like, what do you want the novel to say about class? I mean, we meet the Hudsons, who are kind of scraping just to survive, and then the Davenports fighting over an inheritance that, quite frankly, they may never see. Because somebody has to die for you to get an inheritance. And if there's immortality, then yeah. So, you know, the differences are really stark and immediate when you read this book. And each person is, even within the families, each individual is dealing with their lot differently. So what do you want a reader to walk away thinking about, contemplating about our class structure after reading your book? And also how that class structure is going to be impacted by all the changes that are taking place. And that's a really long, loaded question. I'm sorry.
No, I think it's a perfectly fair question given the nature of my novel. I think one thing that's really important to me as a writer is that I don't want to tell anybody how to think about anything. I just want to get people thinking about these issues and forming their own opinions. And that's what I hope to do with class. I don't want people to ignore it and just live in their little bubbles. I want them to pay attention to it, think about it, consider the aspects of it that are problematic, and draw their own conclusions. And so what I try to do here really is just present a lot of different perspectives about class in the context of this near future world and let people draw their own conclusions or form their own opinions, whatever those are. And I may disagree with them, and that's okay. I think that writers really do a disservice to readers when they're like, here is my agenda, here is what I want you to think. It can be a little heavy-handed, it can be a little insulting. And that's the last thing I want to do to my readers. I don't think it's my place. And I think reasonable minds can disagree on this. But for me, my goal really is just to get people thinking about this in a way that hopefully they haven't before, and to be forming opinions of their own.
Yeah, of course, I totally agree. I mean, I always think about this Venn diagram that people give, like what we think the author meant and what the author meant. Like there's very little overlap, right? But I guess that I would like to reframe that question maybe a little bit and ask, what do you think about the way that class is playing out as the world is changing and access to technology is becoming so important in terms of opportunities for advancement?
Yeah, I think it's a real problem, honestly. I think, first of all, ChatGPT is going to be a really interesting thing to watch, because it's the first time that technology is really going to affect white collar jobs. I think typically we've seen factory jobs disappearing, we've seen retail jobs disappearing a little bit, we've seen blue collar jobs And unskilled labor, we've seen those jobs sort of become fewer and fewer as a result of automation or outsourcing. But white-collar jobs, educated jobs, those have typically not been affected. But I have a friend who's a technical writer who recently lost her job because they realized that that ChatGPT could get their company 70% of the way, and then they could hire one or two people to tidy that up instead of having a whole team of writers to do their writing. So I think that's a really interesting thing, and it's going to be curious to see how people who typically haven't suffered the negative effects of technology react to that, and if it leads to any changes in how we feel about technology. The other thing that I think is scary is exactly what you said, which is that technology gets better and better. The jobs for unskilled laborers are just going to be fewer and fewer. And I don't know that we have been as thoughtful about that issue as we should. And I think it's something that's really important. I think preserving social mobility is really important. And that's going to be harder and harder because if you don't have access to a computer, if you don't have access to a school that's teaching you how to program or how to, you know, I mean, there are just so many the skill sets that we need to thrive in the modern world are changing so rapidly. And I think that schools that serve certain populations or families that have certain resources are in a wonderful position to take advantage of that. But I worry that we're not considering what's going to happen, honestly, to the masses, like not even to just poor or lower middle class families, but to most families. So I'm very curious to see. I mean, that's one of the purposes of my novel, is to get people thinking about these questions, because I think they are going to be very serious issues for the next generation or two.
Yeah, I agree. And it's something I thought about a lot as I was reading. I was actually talking to my daughter about it, you know, this whole idea. And I'm going to ask you about the education part of it as well in the novel, this whole idea of what do you, if you didn't have to work, if you didn't need to, in order to eat, to survive, to, you know, to live, if you didn't need education, all this sort of thing, would you still seek it? Would you still seek upward mobility? And so, you know, education is really central to this novel, as is the idea of like a meritocracy, intelligence, and hard work alone being able to give someone access to a better life. And it just, as we grapple in real life with ideas around the role of standardized testing and how it helps or harms certain communities. I mean, this, it's just such a complicated issue. Like, how does the culture of, in the book, there's a exam called the National Placement Exam, which one of the characters, Remy, has to pass because she wants to get into Ivy League college. How does that play into just the thematic function of education in the story, and, you know, the ideas that you're thinking about and trying to play with in the story?
Yeah, I think education is just such a hugely important thing. There's no issue that's more important to me. But when I was writing the novel, one of the things I wanted to point out is that it's not as simple as sort of going to school and working hard for a lot of people. There's many hidden factors that go into academic success. In the case of my novel, wealthy families in preparation for the national placement exam are doing a lot of the things that families in real life do in preparation for the SAT. So they're hiring tutors, they're taking test prep courses, they are getting accommodations so they get extra time on the exam or a different space, like they can take the exam in a private room or, you know, whatever the accommodation is. And these are all resources that a lot of families don't have access to. And so I think it's important to acknowledge sort of those subtle things that can affect the way that students perform on these sorts of exams or the outcomes they have when they're looking towards college and to getting an education and that can affect social mobility. But I also think that the other thing that my novel points out is, you know, Remy is living on one of these compounds where they do have school, they do have, you know, standard public school education, but it's a culture that doesn't value education. And as a result, there aren't as many resources put into that as we would like. There isn't a community that is supportive of these endeavors. And that's something that we don't talk a lot about. And that can be a really difficult thing too. I mean, I've seen a lot of articles recently about increased absenteeism in schools since the pandemic. When I think about that, I think that's got to be, and it's across classes, and it's not like limited to one socioeconomic group or one race or anything like that. But I have to think it's the sort of thing that is only going to hurt social mobility, because ultimately, if you come from an upper middle class family, they're going to find a way to help you get a good job anyway. Whereas if you're at the bottom and you're not going to school and you don't have a culture that supports school, I don't know. It's just the sort of thing that's only going to make it harder. And my point is just, there's so many factors that go into success. It isn't just a matter of turning up every day, working hard and getting straight A's or hoping to get straight A's. It's your family life. It's your culture. It's the people around you and how supportive they are. It's vision. It's role models. It's having access to resources. And I just feel like we don't discuss or acknowledge that nearly as much as we should be. And I think that's because it's so much easier to look for simpler, more obvious solutions instead of discussing and looking for solutions to very complex and very difficult problems.
Yeah, thank you for such a detailed answer. I really agree with so much of what you just said. And one of the things that is really interesting to me in all of that that you explained is that there's seven central characters in this book. There's the Hudsons, Remy, Henry, Ben, and Zeke, and then the Davenports, Pierce, Sabrina, and Darcy. And, you know, you're kind of moving through all their different perspectives, and each of them, like the Hudsons, are all kind of in the same environment. They've all experienced this abject poverty, which leads them to get themselves onto the compounds. But they all respond to this opportunity in different ways. And part of that kind of feeds into what you were just saying in terms of the experiences, the culture that you grew up around, what the people around you are saying about education, about the opportunities, you know, the access that you have to resources. I guess the question that I have is that you could easily have just had two people in the Hudson's family. So why did you choose to accommodate this point of view of all seven characters? Each of them is having this individual experience with the situation in which they found themselves. They're responding to their situations differently. So how is each of those perspectives essential to your story?
Yeah, I think this goes back to something that I mentioned earlier, which is this notion of not telling people what to think, but wanting to get them thinking about this issue. And I think that one advantage that comes with having a lot of different perspectives is that you get a lot of different perspectives on this issue. And so you can consider it from multiple points of view and maybe think about it in a way that you haven't thought about it before. And that's really what I was going for. If I cut each family down to two characters each, you wouldn't get as many different perspectives. You wouldn't be thinking about as many topics. And, you know, maybe the story would have been more straightforward and a little bit less complex. But I like the complexity because these are complex issues. And so it's important to me to have as many perspectives as is reasonable. And I appreciate that I may be pushing the outer boundary of that with seven. But I really just appreciate having all of those different perspectives in there, because I think that they give readers hopefully more food for thought through the lens of characters that they hopefully find compelling and or sympathetic.
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, even though there were seven characters, and generally that would be a lot, but they really, I think each was so unique in their experiences. I felt so connected, like to Zeke. Oh my goodness, I was really, you know, rooting for him throughout. And I feel like it was important and it was necessary. And so I was very willing to go along with it and to get to know all of these characters very, you know, intimately. I was, and I think you did that really well in terms of getting us to connect to each one of them and to understand each one of them, and for each one of them to be really unique in terms of their experience of this world that you built. So I really do think that you did a great job with that.
Thank you. And I have to say that Zeke is my favorite character, so I'm glad that you singled him out in particular.
Yes, yes, yes. He was mine. He was mine too. I don't want to give anything away about his trajectory, but as I said, I was really rooting for him. As you know, it also brought up this whole the family dynamics, you know, about where you fall in the as the first child, second child, you know, that sort of that sort of thing, and how much attention, you know, the youngest maybe gets all the attention, but the middle one or the one before the youngest kind of might fall through the cracks. And I'm always like a sucker for that one, you know, wanting to give them
Are
a
you
hand.
a middle child?
I'm actually an only child.
Okay, me too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. So, and it's great because, you know, so many stories are about only children. I think in a way it's easier to write that, unless the story is relating to their experiences with their other siblings. But there's so many stories. So it's really lovely to read something where you're seeing that family experience, you're seeing how they're working together, and how each of them can just really be so different and individual, even having grown up under the same experiences and the same very particular experiences. Because the other thing I was going to go on to is that, you know, we've been talking about these seven characters, but of course there are secondary characters that we haven't really talked about yet. And I feel like they also play, even some of them that just pop in for a little bit, like Prince's secretary, or you know, that they play this crucial role as well, and you do a good job of just painting them really quickly, even as they pop in and out of the story. But particularly the parents of the Hudsons. So the Hudsons is a family that was very impoverished, and the children moved into the compound where they're donating their blood twice a week to support the immortality. And but their parents, Irene and Vance, Irene especially, she's a very religious woman. She feels very strongly about not bringing her children to compound, and I totally got it. Even as they were experiencing homelessness, can you talk a little bit about like how you see what you were thinking in terms of the interaction between religion and poverty, and not, I know not what you wanted us to think, but what were you thinking about as you were writing her into the story?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. I don't know that I was thinking specifically about religion and poverty. I think I was thinking about trade-offs we have to make, and I think especially when you have fewer resources, you are more inclined to be in a position where you have to make those trade-offs. And so for Eileen, it was something very closely held, right? It's like religion or feeding my family. And she chose religion without even a second thought, right? And I don't think that's an unreasonable choice. I know a lot of people might, but I think that for a lot of people, they would say, well, yeah, my eternal soul, my eternal fate is more important than my earthly fate. And so I think really creating that tension wasn't specifically about religion and poverty, but it was about the trade-offs that the poor are often forced to make, or the very difficult decisions that they have to make. So that's what I was going for in that situation specifically.
Yeah, and it's interesting because even as I recognize, I mean, that most reasonable people would think that she was being unreasonable. Her children were like, they had nothing to eat. They couldn't go to school. They were begging. They were, you know, Zeke was out on the street. His father was kind of not pimping him out in terms of sexual favors, but I think that was probably next. And so this was a pretty desperate situation, but I feel like she just had this stance, and it wasn't only about religion, I felt, but it was kind of a principle, a stance on principle, that this idea of giving my blood so that someone else can live forever was just not right, and not something that she wanted to become a part of, and something that I think she saw was maybe going to lead to some much larger wrong in the end. And I think the story sort of hints at that so much. There's a sense throughout it that there's another shoe that's going to drop, that, you know, the compounds, and she helps to build that tension. The compounds are going to be some this terrifying dystopian horror, or the process to become immortal or give immortality is going to, you know, turn out to be something else. And but instead, the dangers that come up in this book are so organic, and in a real way, they are scarier than any monster that you might have conjured up. So, can you speak to this idea of sort of inverting the trope of speculative fiction with the compounds, and trying to, you know, having this tension, I guess, between what the readers expect and what actually happens in the narrative. Like, you know, is that something that you thought about or considered as you were writing?
Nope, not at all. honestly, I told the story I wanted to tell, and I didn't think about what other people had written or what the tropes were or what was expected. I had a story in mind, and it didn't involve having the corporation as the big baddie. And if it had, then I would have written that story and not worried about that. But as it was, it just simply wasn't where I was headed. And so I don't know. I think that's kind of maybe a disappointing answer. But I should be like, yes, I wanted to show people that, you know, I have a different plot line in mind and look at how creative I am. But it was nothing like that. It was just me writing the story I wanted to write. And it was the story turned out to be what the story wanted to be. And as it happens, you're right. I think it doesn't sort of follow the standard sci-fi fantasy tropes. But also, I have no idea how to write action sequences. And I think a lot of those tropes require, like a lot of sci-fi requires that. And that wasn't happening. So it just wasn't going to go in that direction.
No, and I think that's perfectly fine. You know, I tell people all the time, you got to write the story that you want to write, that you can write, that works for you. And trying to fit into some particular mold or to say, okay, well, this is what it's expected of me next is just not going to, it's never a good pass. You know, the book as it is, it feels, as I said, so organic. Like the way that it unfolds just makes sense. It's just like, this is the way this story is going to go. And so I think it was very successful, and I'm really happy that you didn't like try to follow any trends. And I wonder, this is I wonder how you think that not having had a formal education in writing may have sort of helped this this situation and helped the way that you approached your book and approached your writing. So I guess in there is a little bit of a question about how you came to writing. So if you could talk a little bit about that, if you'd like.
Oh, sure. I came to write. How did I come to writing? That is a very good question. I'm a lawyer by training. And so I was working as a corporate lawyer, which is a dreadful profession. it pays the bills, but it is a dreadful profession. And whenever work was slow at my law firm, instead of asking for more work, which is what you're supposed to do, I would just sort of start writing a novel. This is one of those novels. This is not this novel, by the way. This is one of those novels that's in my bottom drawer. But I found I was really happy doing it, and I really enjoyed writing. And I never would have pursued it professionally. I'm just far too risk averse for that. But then my husband, who's an academic, had a sabbatical coming up, and we weren't going to be able to go anywhere because of my job. And he said, you know, you seem to really be enjoying writing. What are your thoughts on taking a leave of absence and maybe working on a novel for a year? And I jumped at that chance so fast. And then I just never went back to law. And so, yeah, I got very fortunate to have a supportive partner. And it's been, I think, a longer process for me, slower, harder process, because I have just sort of learned by doing a lot. And I've also gone to some writers' workshops. I've been to Breadloaf and the community of writers in Olympic Valley and Futurescapes. And I've learned a lot at all of those. I have a writers group, many of whom have MFAs, and I've learned a lot from them. So although I haven't taken any sort of formal creative writing classes and I don't have a degree in it, I certainly have learned a lot from a lot of different people and from just doing it a lot. In fact, the first couple of years that I was a writer, I didn't take it very seriously. I was just traveling a lot and enjoying having free time. And when I really started to improve as a writer is when I grew up and started treating it as a career instead of as a hobby. And then since then, I've seen noticeable improvement in my writing and storytelling. So, yeah, I mean, I guess I think I probably missed out on a lot of great mentorship that comes with MFAs or that can come with MFA programs, a lot of more formal skills. There are some things, like, I mean, I can't write an action sequence. I also really, one thing I've really had to work on is writing emotion. That's not something that comes naturally to me. And so I think in some ways it's been a lot harder, but it maybe also is less confining. I don't feel tied to any sort of narrative structure or any stylistic flourishes or anything like that. But I also don't really have a sort of strong sense of what people, I don't really have a strong sense of what an MFA entails. So maybe I'm getting this all wrong and that's not what an MFA is at all. No, I don't know.
No, I mean, I do think that, well, full disclosure, I do have an MFA, but I do think that there's a lot to be said for raw talent and for learning as you go along. I had a mentor a long time ago when I just got started as well, who kind of looked at my work and he was like, okay, you know, I can see there's something here, but you need, there's some things you need to learn. And, but they weren't.
That sounds amazing. Like, I would have loved that.
Right. But the thing is that they weren't earth-shattering secrets or anything like that. They were pretty small things. And once I figured those out, I was able to, I think, to improve my writing exponentially. And but I think that what you're doing in terms of going to these workshops and finding mentors and having a writing group can just do so much for your writing if once you're able to listen to the feedback, to assess whether the feedback helps you or is going to be helpful for you or not. I think that all of that can make an amazing writer. And I'm an academic, so I'm not going to knock going to school, but...
Don't put yourself out of a job.
I know, exactly. Because AI is coming for it anyway, so...
I don't think that ChatGPT can give the kind of feedback that people can give. I think it can give feedback, actually, but not like not the kind of feedback that people can give, at least not at this point.
Not yet. So you did mention you're writing, you're working on something now. And I also have to add this dreaded question, what's next? Because I know that after readers read Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality, they are going to want to read more from you. So what can we expect? What can we look forward to?
This is an excellent question. I don't know for sure yet. I've just finished a short story collection. Some of those pieces have been published already and some of them haven't, as is typical for short story collections, I guess. And I don't know, my agent is going to try to sell it and hopefully she'll be successful in, you know, sometime in the next 3 years or so, because it's such a long process. Maybe there will be a short story collection out there by me.
Is it speculative fiction as well, or is it
the stories all have a speculative component to them. My stories generally, I think they're sort of our world with a twist, and then I just explore how that twist plays out in, you know, sometimes in 75,000 words and sometimes in 3,000 words.
Yes. Well, I really look forward to reading that. As someone who's also working on a short story collection, I know that it's a struggle, and it's also, people always say that short story collections don't sell well, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. I do think that they're doing much better, and I love to read them.
Me too. I really do.
Yours, when it comes out. So keep us posted, because whatever you do going forward is also going to help Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality. So we're definitely going to support whatever you have coming up.
Yeah, that would be great. And I look forward to reading your short story collection. That sounds wonderful.
Thank you. I appreciate that. It has been wonderful chatting with you about your work and about this book, Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality. So it was published by Stillhouse Press, released in November 23rd, I believe, in 2023. And you can purchase a copy at the Stillhouse Press website, stillhousepress.org, then go to the books tab. Or you can pick one up wherever books are sold. So I always have to give up my plug for reviewing. You can support authors and small presses by writing reviews about books that you love. Don't write reviews about the books you don't love. That's just mean.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know.
And asking,
really, I never do. I'm sorry. I don't mean to cut in and interrupt, but I can't do it. It's just like people have put so much of themselves into this project that even if I didn't love it, I don't need to say that publicly.
Exactly. I think that's just a me thing, right? Most of the time. I mean, sometimes there are books that are just objectively, you know, grammar filled with grammatical errors or, you know, that sort of thing. But if, you know, someone has put a genuine effort into a book and I don't like it, I think that's just a me thing and I can keep that to myself. But if you love the book, then write a review, ask about them, ask for the books, ask for Finding Meaning in the Age of Immortality at your library and at your neighborhood bookstores. So thank you so much for listening to Moonshine Murmurs. Please subscribe so that you'll know when our next podcast becomes available. And thanks so much, Tia and Ears, for being here today.
Thank you, Carol. I've really enjoyed this.
The Moonshine Murmurs podcast is produced by Stillhouse Press staff in coordination with Watershed Lit. For more episodes and updates, be sure to follow us on Spotify, Twitter, and Instagram. Stillhouse Press is a student-led craft publisher working with George Mason University and Watershed Lit. You can find out more about Stillhouse Press and upcoming releases and events at stillhousepress.org. Thank you for listening.